Welcome to Faded Mates. This week, it's a hype video in podcast form for Brazen and the Beast. I'm super excited about it, but I don't actually know how to make hype videos at all. But I like watching them. So I just want you to imagine it's like me and like Megan Rapinoe and the entire U.S. women's soccer team being like, Wit, Beast, Brazen, like Hetty. That's like the mood I need you in right now, everybody.
Aww, this is so nice.
I'm so excited. So, Sarah.
Yes, Jen. This is real weird. Welcome to Faded Mates, everyone.
I don't actually have a co-host today. I have someone very special joining me who's going to talk to us about her new book. Right? Where can we find you, Sarah? No, I'm kidding. Sarah, the reason that we are having this very special podcast, this interstitial, is your new book comes out next week, and I want everyone to know that Sarah was like, should we do this? Are you okay with it? And I was like, look, if we cannot hype ourselves on our own podcast, then like, really, what is it for?
It's true. What would you do if you had a penis?
The
Carrie Ryan question is always like, just what would you do if you were a dude? Like, okay.
Yeah. Well, you channel your inner awesomeness and tell everybody about how great your new book is. So
yeah, I have a new book out. Also, I don't write like a book every month, so it feels less like horrifying to me. Although it is slightly horrifying to spend a half an hour talking about my book to you guys. But I write books, you guys.
You do.
And I have one coming out.
I think I have some good questions that I want us to talk about.
Yeah, what's super weird is Jen has, like, prepared for this. You know, so Jen read Brazen, what, like, two or three months ago? Months ago.
Right.
And I was just like, can we just, you know, talk about Hetty and Wit and, like, how we like competence porn and ladies with businesses and just that's that, like, do 15 minutes on Brazen. And Jen was like, yeah, that's fine. And then this morning she was like, I have questions. I've been rereading. Like, oh my God.
So I've got to tell you, like, I'm a big rereader, but I love a book when you're reading it the first time and then you purposefully slow down because you know that you're coming to the end and you don't want it to end. And that's what happened to me when I read this book. And then I was like, I'll just do some quick preparation. I'll reread. And then I was literally like, I just now have to reread the whole thing because I'm enjoying it all over again. Oh. So that is like a very sweet spot.
Well, I'm really glad. And you were reading an advanced copy where there's a desk on a roof and some other problems.
That level of detail is not really my strong suit, so don't worry.
For those of you who don't know, there are advanced copies of romance novels that get sent around to, you know, important, very important journalists at, say, Kirkus Reviews, like my friend Jen, but to librarians and to booksellers and to early reviewers, people who have blogs and, you know, Instagram influencers and things like that. But those copies have a big sign on, stamp on them that say, like, advanced, uncorrected proof, like, check the quotes against the final document. And mostly my books don't change a huge amount after this. But in this particular case, when I was reading typeset pages, which is what is bound up for early reviewers, I discovered that I had originally written a scene inside the warehouse where everybody was at desks. And then I moved it to a rooftop. And at one point, one of the characters stands up from his desk on the roof.
They do spend a lot of time outside in this book, Sarah. So
it's
fine.
True, mostly outside. But but what was funny is I was like, God damn it, somebody's gonna review this on Goodreads and say there's a desk on the roof in this book, and sure enough,
there would be.
Instantly, yeah. It happened. So
Sarah, before we start talking about some of the particulars, why don't you tell us about Wit and Hetty?
Oh, Wit and Hetty.
Oh, they're so good.
I haven't talked a lot about this book, so now I'm going to just stumble through, but...
That's okay.
Wit, this is the second book in my Bare Knuckle Bastard series. Wit is the quiet bastard. So Devil, who's the main character, the hero of Wicked and the Wallflower, is very verbal. Like, he always has something to say. He's very quick-witted. There's just never a moment when Devil can't, like, cut you with words.
Right.
Wit is a silent, grunty...
Oh, my God.
...brute.
Like, oh, my God. The grunting and the growling.
He's a grunty, growly bruiser of a hero. who I invented way back in Day of the Duchess. And I was like, oh, it's going to be so great. He's going to be like super silent and like basically only make Tom Hardy grunting noises. But then I had to write a book where there had to be dialogue, which was complicated. Anyway, so Wit is the strong silent type. And the way the setup of the series is that these two brothers and their badass sister are the Bare Knuckle Bastards, and they run Covent Garden, which is not the greatest neighborhood of London. It's filled with rookeries, which are where very, very poor people in London lived in the 1900s. In the 19th century. And they run a rookery, and they are basically like kings and queen of the rookery, and they take care of the people in the rookery. There's running water in their rookery. There's the children learn to read in their rookery. There's a church in their rookery. Like it's a community that's taken care of, despite the fact that there's very little money there. And Wit is the savior. His name is Destiny. His name is actually Savior. He's named for the orphanage for the hospital where he was born. And he is the savior. He cares very deeply about protecting his people, the people he loves, the people who he is responsible for, his family, and ultimately his love. His love, who is Hattie, who will take none of his shit.
Like, okay, so let me talk about how I don't want to like spoil anything, so it's like really tricky because everybody just needs to pre-order and get ready, but it does have this amazing beginning where it is the eve of Hattie's 29th birthday, and she is determined to make it the year of Hattie, and she has a lot of plans. And that really spoke to me as a reader, because I feel like I'm a person who's like, okay, I need to change something, and how am I going to do it? And then like that really speaks to me. And it also, I think, speaks to the kind of character she is. So she's getting ready to go into her carriage with her best friend for the night of the plan. She's finally going to like execute this plan. And she finds Beast, right? She finds Wit like bound up and shot or on the bottom
of her. He's not shot.
He's not shot.
But he is bound up. He's unconscious and bound up on the floor of her carriage, and exceedingly inconvenient.
Yes.
Hattie has fucking plans.
Yes.
Like, and they do not involve handsome, unconscious men.
Oh, God, and I love it when she, like, so she, you know, her friend Nora's like, don't even look at him. And she's like, I kind of want to look at him. Like, who is this guy? And that, like, he's just so beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Right? So Beast is, Beast, name is Destiny. Beast is, like, the hottest.
Of course.
Human being ever. Like,
sure.
Ever.
Ever. So empirically, I think she even says.
Yeah. Like, she's like, there's no getting around it. This man is stunningly attractive.
It's what's great about this is I think a lot of readers like really love a story where it's like just like jump starts, right? Like it's like they're sort of I sometimes like draw this like shape with my hand. Like you can have this slow ramp up. But this book, instead, it's like falling off a cliff, right? Like, it's just all action at the beginning. And I think it really sets the stage for, like, an exciting book. So, Sarah, I do have some questions for you. I've, like, kind of prepared them. One of the things that I think is really interesting in this book is one of her big plans is about their family business, which is, like, a shipping business. And one of the things we see a lot of in... Well, I think there's, like, actually been a shift towards, like, working women in historicals.
Yes.
This is something I've noticed in a lot of books. Why do you think that that's something that, like, we see popping up in historicals now? Like, how is that informing who we are now as women?
Yeah, I think we're starting to see more working women across the board in romance. Look, we've seen working women since the dawn of romance, but in the early days of romance, in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, the women were often like secretaries or, you know, teachers or nurses. And now we're starting to see women in all walks of life. Like, we're starting to see women who want to own businesses and women who are running their own companies and running their own show. Women who are, you know, chefs and restaurateurs and police officers, and, you know, like, every, you can find a romance about you know, Tessa Bailey likes to say, like, who do you want to be today? The reason why romance is so great is because you can say, who do you want to be today? And you can read that person in their best life.
Yeah.
And now you can say, who do I want to be today? I want to be a woman who runs, like, a hand, I want to be a hand letterer. Like, well, yeah. Kate Claiborne's got a book coming for you. You know, I want to be a wedding planner. Like, there's that. So I also think setting women, working women in historicals allows you to have the very real conversation about women at work now in the world here now in 2019, right?
Yeah.
Like, you get to have the conversation about, like, equal access, equal pay, like, workplace dynamics. Like, you get to have the conversation about, like, only, you know, 5% of Fortune 500 CEOs are women. Well, like, obviously, I'm not having that exact conversation with Hattie, but Hattie wants to run her father's business and is the perfect person to do it, but is prevented from being able to do it by virtue of her being a woman.
Yeah.
No other reason.
No other reason.
Everybody acknowledges, like, her father even says, like, if you were a boy, it would be yours.
Her brother is essentially her competition for the family business, right?
Yeah.
Like, it should go to him because he's a man, but she is, like, making this case for herself. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting about Augie, about her brother, is so often in romance, like, we see that, like, this person is going to end up a hero, like, and Augie's never going to end up a Sarah McLean hero, never.
No.
Right? Like, no one's going to be calling you and being like, but what about Augie, the way they still do, right? The way they still do with
Benedict.
Yeah, right? That's never going to happen. So what is it like to write, like, kind of purposefully write in, like, an anti-hero in the heroine's story, like, as a family member, as opposed to, like, a, I don't know, an outside villain or whatever?
Well, sometimes, look, Augie's not a villain.
No, he's not.
He's not smart.
He's spoiled.
He makes bad choices. He's super entitled. He's all the things, you know, frankly, I mean, like, he's all the things that can come of having just unchecked money and privilege.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's what he has. His father has a life. Their father has a life peerage. He has been such a successful shipping magnate that he literally received a life peerage for his successes and, like, the benefits that he brought to the Docklands and to London and to the UK. And so, you know, they're the children. So Augie sort of has, like, all the benefits of being a peer with none of the responsibilities, because he's never going to have to be an earl. He's never going to have to sit in a parliament. He's never going to have to do anything. He can just be idly rich.
Yeah.
And so he has this, like, kind of thuggish buddy, and, like, the two of them, you know, they just are idly rich,
right?
They make stupid mistakes, and they get themselves way too deep into what is ultimately the conflict between Wit and his estranged brother.
Well, and that's the other reason it's really interesting, is because there's this setup, like, you know, where, of course, though, unlike Augie, Ewan is going to be a hero, right?
Yeah.
But I am fine with it, because it's clear to me he's already been paying the price for being a jerk for, like, 2 decades.
Oh, so. Ewan is being put through the ringer every day.
I need you to know that I appreciate that, because he deserves it.
He's, as you like to say, he's been in cold storage for a long time.
One of the reasons you are not only my friend, but one of my favorite authors, is that you have a finely tuned understanding of how much suffering someone needs to do when they have done wrong. And Ewan has been in, like, Siberia storage, which is great. But yeah, I mean, like, sort of that role of family. And I think it's also really interesting because, of course, in historicals and in contemporaries, we get, like, doubting family members. Are you sure you're really going to be able to do that thing? But, you know, this act, like, when your family is kind of actively holding you back, that is really hard to take. And I think it's what makes her, you know, even more.
Yeah, and it's really disappointing, too, when your family, like, in this particular, in Hattie's case, she knows that she's the best person for the job. Her brother knows, her father knows, everyone knows she's the best person for the job. And she's still, that's not enough.
Yeah.
And then she gets, every time she gets even, like, remotely close to proving it again, or bearing fruit that, you know, her hopes bearing fruit, they sort of smack her down again. Right. And we've all been there, right? Like, where we're the only one, or rather, we believe in ourselves. And, like, look, let's be clear. Hattie has a ride or die bestie
who's, oh, yeah, like,
I will always be there. I will always drive. I will drive your getaway car.
Yeah.
Is literally Nora's job.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, luckily Hattie has a Nora, and that was really fun. I have not written a best friend, I think, ever. Like a real deal best friend. I've written a lot of sisters.
You have, and I think a lot of your male characters, a lot of your heroes have best friends or really tight friends that way. But
yeah,
that was interesting to me too, because Nora also felt like something new for you, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Exciting. Okay, I only have a couple more questions because we have something exciting happening at the end of this. But okay. Sarah, I like to think that I am a smart reader who can figure things out, but there is one thing, and I like it's literally been killing me. Okay,
I'm scared of this question already.
No, I don't think you should be. I think you're going to have an answer, and if not, you're going to write one in, so it's okay. Mm. Felicity is an expert at locks. Mm-hmm. Hattie is an expert at knots. What is Grace going to be an expert at? I mean, I was like, something mechanical, puzzle. Like, I like literally have been like racking my brains because I can't figure out what would be like the third thing, right?
Well, so here's the deal. Grace has a weapon. So all the Bare-Knuckle Bastards have weapons.
Yes.
Remember, Grace is both heroine and bastard.
Sure.
Right?
So yeah.
She is like all ending Sarah McLean heroines in a series. Like, Grace has to be all things.
Yes.
She's and each of the Bare-Knuckle Bastards, Wit and Devil, both at certain points in their books have basically said, like, we're nothing compared
right.
to what Grace is.
Yeah.
So I don't want to give too much away about Grace. I will say Grace has a weapon. And
wait, so before you say anything more, because it's interesting, because I was also thinking about that, right? So Devil has like his staff, right, with like the knife in it, and mm-hmm. Devil has his like a
yeah, Wit wears a cage,
a holster,
of knives.
Yeah. But you know what else Devil has, or what Wit has, is he has his two watches.
Yeah,
right. And so I was like, I don't know. You don't have to answer, but everybody else, you could be watching for it, because I was really interested in this idea that like all of the heroines in this series show like a proficiency with some sort of thing. I mean, that's, like, both kind of symbolic, right? I mean, Felicity's really unlocking herself and unlocking Devil and, like, unlocking this future for herself. And Hattie, on the other hand, is, like, desperately trying to, like, hook on and tie herself onto this future that she wants.
Right.
So, like, those made sense to me, right? Like, I was very proud of your Lisa Claypas, like, right, use of talismans and symbols, right?
My talismans.
But, yeah, I sometimes try and figure out what the third one is. And I was like... Oh, what's it gonna be?
Well,
you don't have to tell me.
It's no, but I will say this: Grace is an expert in many, many, many things. Like Grace is Grace. Like, she's the queen.
Yeah,
and you know, but there are a lot of things about Grace that I think are really interesting. Grace is we know this already. She's a lady bare-knuckle boxer. So you know, she runs a brothel,
and she has like lieutenants.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Grace's expertise is in the physical. Like, she is a very physical heroine in a way that Felicity is very intellectual,
right.
And Hattie is very like focused and like business minded. Also,
right,
Grace, you know, to use a Cressley Cole term, Grace is Josie, right? Squeeze it till it breaks.
Yeah,
but also always one step ahead of everybody. Except maybe you, and I don't know.
Because you're still writing. Okay, back to Hattie and Wit, though. So my last question, and again, I don't want it to be spoilery, but another thing, I feel like we in Romancelandia, and you and me for sure, like, love a hero who says mine. And we love a hero who's like kind of possessive and caretaking. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, like, if you could talk about the evolution of... your heroines, like, over time, what I see are, like, you creating heroines who can accept that, but also are not going to be controlled by that.
Right. You can't ultimately, right? Like, yes, it's deeply appealing when a hero says, mine, 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 and all my heroes ultimately do, right?
Right.
But it's not mine. It's your mine and I'm yours.
Yeah.
And in order for that to be the case, the heroine has to be strong enough to say, you don't get to have me if I don't get to have you too.
Right.
And so the evolution of, I think probably, you know, my friend Louisa likes to say, like, the Sarah McLean ethos is like, and then she rescues him right back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's, you know, which is from Pretty Woman. But, you know, that's the whole of it. And the only way that you can sort of rescue the mine hero, the caretaking hero, is to say, like, I'm yours whether you're touching me or whether you're with me or not.
Right.
Right. Like, you have to let me be. You fell for me as an entity, as myself. And I have to be myself first. And
yeah.
Then only then do we work together.
Yeah.
So, you know, Sarah McLean heroines would be totally fine on their own.
Right.
And are just better for, you know, having.
Right. A partner. Well, and a partner who respects them ultimately.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that's like a really important part of like why it all works. Right. But I definitely think that that's, even though that's always been the case with your books. I mean, I've reread like 9 Rules probably 3 times this year because I love it so much. But Callie is still like in the ballrooms, right? Like you have your evolution as a writer. It's like that core story is sometimes the same, but like where you're placing those stories and the kinds of, you know, the evolution of like heroes and heroines and their dramas and dilemmas. I think it's like really, like you're not a writer who's like, I'm just writing the same thing every time.
No, I wish. Sometimes I wish I were. I mean, I do. I don't know if that's, I don't do that. So I don't know if it's easier, but I do feel like it's always like I'm writing into the darkness for, you know, 50,000 words before I'm like, oh, this is who I'm writing. Although I will say Hattie came real clear to me real fast. She's probably my most personal heroine. Like I mean, there's a lot about her that's a lot like me. That said, I think, no, you're right. Like the Sarah McLean heroine has, their DNA is, Callie's DNA is Hattie's DNA. The strand is there. The strain
right.
is there. It's the family tree. But no, I, you know, when you ask the question about heroines who have jobs, right?
Yeah.
I feel like I've written, half of my heroines have had jobs. You know, Mara runs an orphanage. Chase is Chase.
Yes.
What's her name? Sophie runs a bookstore. Serafina is a, like, runs a collection of taverns.
Right.
And then, you know, now we have Hattie, who cares really deeply about running a real business. Like, she wants to be basically like a magnet.
Yeah.
But the idea now is that I'm happier outside of ballrooms than I am inside of ballrooms.
Yeah.
Because I feel like then you can really set a heroine free. Like,
yeah.
A ballroom is very cloying. It traps a heroine. And, like, they're super useful. There's a ballroom scene in this book. Like, I haven't given up beautiful dresses.
Right.
Madame Hébert still makes dresses for all my heroines. But there is something really compelling to me about, like, taking the heroine out of the ballroom and setting her down, like, in the streets.
Yeah.
And saying, like, okay, you want to be a strong, like, you want to live on your own and, like, be strong. Like, be strong where you have to be strong.
The last time I read 9 Rules, there are one part, we like joke about Sweet Rain, and that's not the thing, that's not the thing that you would never put in a book anymore. There's this one scene in particular where Callie is fighting with, what's his name? And like,
Ralston.
I'm like, how did I forget that? Because I love him. Fucking Ralston. She's fighting with Ralston and she says something to him about like, your sister is facing the most like difficult time of her life.
Yeah.
Right? And I was like,
Is she, though?
Yeah, you, Sarah, now would never write that line anymore, no. Right? That's where I see, like, no. The change. Is...
Yeah, and we shouldn't cut that. That's not, like, that's yeah. real. Like, that's an evolution.
Yeah.
That's an evolution of me as, like, a person, right? I wrote Callie when I was in my 20s. I'm 40 now. Like, life yeah. is different for me now. I've seen more. I've done more.
Yeah.
It's an evolution of the world. I wrote that book 12 years ago. The world was different 12 sure. years ago. Women's place in the world surely was the same, but it didn't feel so terrifying 12 years
right.
ago.
Right.
And on top of it, romance was different 12 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
I say all the time, like, I feel like Nine Rules is my homage to the real Regencies, like the yeah. old, like, big Regencies,
yeah,
like, big ballroom Regencies. Like, I feel like Stephanie Lawrence and, like, Julia Quinn
yes.
and Eloisa James, like, the kind of, like, doyens of the Regency. That's what I was reading. Lisa's, like, most ballroomy books.
Yeah.
But now it's like Derek Craven forever, man.
And that's why it's like really funny, because every time I read Nine Rules, like, that's the line where I think, this is how you know Sarah's changed.
Yeah. I mean, well, I also was learning to write romance in that book.
Of course.
That's my first romance novel. I mean, I wrote a YA before that, but, like, that's my first romance novel. I looked through it maybe a year ago, and I was like, wow, there's a lot in this book, a lot packed in.
Yeah.
And because I was, like, trying to figure it out, like, how do you do this?
Yeah.
You know, I know a lot of people love Callie and love Nine Rules, and I hope that they will see that Hattie is, like, Callie's
oh yeah
evolved, like, there she is a natural evolution from Callie.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, by first of all, she's, you know, they're both fat heroines, like, they both
on the shelf, right?
Yeah, they're both on. There's a lot of similarity. They both sort of make a list, even though it's slightly mm-hmm. different.
A different list, yeah.
Yeah, I think Hattie's like Callie's cooler, younger sister.
Yeah. Okay, Sarah, I'm gonna ask you one more question, and I've been interviewing a lot of authors, and this is like a question I really like. I love asking people about their work in general, which is, what's something you wish people would ask you when they were asking you about writing or asking you about your books?
Oh, my God.
I know. People are like, that's a shitty question, Jen. I'm like, no, it's a great question. You can think about it.
What do I wish people would ask me? I'm trying to think, like, what have other people said?
Maybe you are like, we already talk so much about all the things we think.
You know what I wish people would ask me? I wish people would ask me more about where I want to go. Like, what I want the books to be 10 years from now, 20 years from now. I don't know okay. that I have a good answer for that. That's, now that I've said that, I'm like, well, what does that mean? I mean, obviously, I want to be writing 10 years from now. But, like, I think romance, and I've said this 1,000 times as part of the podcast, but romance does so much important work in the world that I want romance to continue to have the kind of powerful impact that it had on me as a kid. Like, I think
yeah.
I started reading romance when I was, you know, I've said it before, too young to be reading romance, but, like, I wasn't too young to be reading romance. Romance taught me that, like, women had agency, that heroines were proactive, that you could expect parity in a relationship, that you could expect love and devotion and intellectual stimulation from a partner, that you could expect sexual agency and sexual pleasure from a partner. And that kind of lesson is so important.
Yeah.
And what I wish people would ask is that. Like, I wish people would say, why are the books good for us?
Yeah.
And too often they ask us, are the books good for us? And I want them to just take that and say, tell me what romance does for us. Like, why does it builds us into strong, smart, proactive, yeah. demanding women and people.
And right.
we should expect that. We should expect it and want yeah. it of our children, especially our daughters. And
well, and that's Hattie, right? Yeah. Like, that's Hattie doing it for herself. And that's why it's such a great, like, such a great read. She's such an amazing... I mean, I love both of them. I really love both of them so much, and everyone else will, too. So...
Well, the reason why people love Wit... I mean, Wit's very grunty and delicious, and, like, if you love Tom Hardy, mm-hmm. you're gonna love Wit. But, you know, Wit just gets... He just gets knocked on his ass by Hattie from the beginning.
The
drop.
Oh, yeah.
It was really fun to write. It's a fun book, I think. It's a really... It's my homage to old school romances a little bit. There's a lot of Cressley in it.
Oh, yeah.
And
he punches a wall, and I was like...
Wait, he does?
Oh, yeah.
Now I can't remember when. Okay, he punches a wall. Oh, wait, he does punch a wall. Now I know why.
I was like, oh... Yeah. He looks at the moon.
Yeah, at one point, like, he's in an early draft, like, he wanted to bring her the heads of her enemies. He's very Cressley. And it's because I've been reading, you know, IAD this whole time. But there's a lot of Cressley in it. There's a lot of old school in it. It's really an adventure novel, I think, in a way that, like, there's a lot more that goes on in here that is adventure-y than in any of my other books.
Yeah, it's great.
So it was really fun to write. And thank you for asking me about it. Thank you guys for tolerating us.
All right. So, Sarah, something amazing is going to happen as we, like, sign off. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. So, audiobooks, I know that a lot of the Fate of Mates listeners listen on audio because we love Robert Petcoff so much.
We do.
I have, like, the Robert Petcoff of ladies as my narrator these days. Her name is Justine Eyre, and I think she's so perfect. She's, like, the perfect narrator for the Bare Knuckle Bastards because she's got this sort of, like, gravelly, like,
she's got a great voice.
Yeah. And so Justine has narrated my book since Never Judge a Lady by Her Cover, for which she won the, like, Best Audiobook of the Year award from her narration group. And so she's narrated this, and HarperCollins has given us, Avon has given us, the first 10 minutes of Brazen and the Beast, which I have not listened to yet, but I hope that you all enjoy. You'll get 10 minutes, the sort of sneak peek of the beginning. You'll find Wit unconscious in Hattie's carriage along with Hattie. Mm-hmm. You'll meet Nora, who is possibly my favorite secondary character that I've ever written. And I hope you love it.
Well, they're going to love it. So pre-order, we'll put links in the show notes. Brazen comes out next week.
Thank you for reading, you guys.
You all better be ready because it's going to be amazing.
And wait, what's happening next week? Next week is Dacian's.
I don't know where we are, Sarah.
I'm so torn. It's ridiculous. Whatever's happening after that
is what's happening, and you're going to be there for it.
Just follow us. Also, I'm going to say I'm actually going to London for release week. So follow me everywhere, and I'll post pictures of all the places in the books and, you know, maybe seek out, I don't know, Wit's house.
There you go.
I know. Watch out, Tom Hardy. Oh, and we'll put in show notes the link to the video that I send to Jen all the time of Tom Hardy grunting.
So I can't believe we haven't already, but this is the time.
I know, well, because he's grunted so much during the podcast already.
Bless his little grunting soul.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Jen. You're being nice to me. Thank you.
Chapter 1. September 1837, Mayfair. In 28 years and 364 days, Lady Henrietta Sedley liked to think that she'd learned a few things. She'd learned, for example, that if a lady could not get away with wearing trousers, an unfortunate reality for the daughter of an earl, even one who had begun life without title or fortune, then she should absolutely ensure that her skirts included pockets. A woman never knew when she might require a bit of rope or a knife to cut it. She'd also learned that any decent escape from her Mayfair home required the cover of darkness and a carriage driven by an ally. Coachmen tended to talk a fine game when it came to keeping secrets, but they were ultimately beholden to those who paid their salaries. An important addendum to that particular lesson was this: the best of allies was often the best of friends. And perhaps first on the list of things she'd learned in her lifetime was how to tie a Carrick Bend knot. She'd been able to do that for as long as she could remember. With such an obscure and uncommon collection of knowledge, one might imagine that Henrietta Sedley would have known precisely what to do in the likelihood she discovered a human male bound and unconscious in her carriage. One would be incorrect. In point of fact, Henrietta Sedley would never have described such a scenario as a likelihood. True, she might have been more comfortable on London's docks than in its ballrooms, but Hattie's impressive collection of life experience lacked anything close to a criminal element. And yet, here she was, pockets full, dearest friend at her side, standing in the pitch dark on the night before her 29th birthday, about to steal away from Mayfair for an evening of best-laid plans, and... Lady Eleonora Maidwell whistled, low and unladylike, at Hattie's ear. Daughter of a duke and the Irish actress he loved so well that he'd made her a duchess, Nora had the kind of brashness that was allowed in those with impervious titles and scads of money. "There's a bloke in the gig, Hattie." Hattie did not look away from the bloke in question. "Yes, I see that." "There wasn't a bloke in the gig when we hitched the horses." "No, there wasn't." They'd left the hitched and most definitely empty carriage in the dark rear drive of Sedley House, not 3/4 of an hour earlier, before hiking upstairs to exchange carriage hitching dresses for attire more appropriate for their evening plans. At some point between corset and coal, someone had left her an extraordinarily unwelcome package. "Seems we would have noticed a bloke in the gig," Nora said. "I should think we would have," came Hattie's distracted reply. "This is really just awful timing." Nora cut her a look. "Is there a good time to find a man bound and unconscious in one's carriage?" Hattie imagined there wasn't, but he could have selected a different evening. "This is a terrible birthday gift." She squinted into the dark interior of the carriage. "Do you think he's dead?" "Please don't let him be dead." Silence. Then a thoughtful, "Does one store dead men in carriages?" Nora reached forward, her coachman's coat pulling tight over her shoulders, and poked the possibly dead man in question. He did not move. "He's not moving," she added with an unhelpful shrug. "Could be dead." Hattie sighed, removing a glove and leaning into the carriage to place two fingers to the man's neck. "I'm sure he's not dead." "What are you doing?" Nora whispered urgently. "If he's not, you'll wake him." "That wouldn't be the worst thing in the world," Hattie pointed out. "Then we could ask him to kindly exit our conveyance and we could be on our way." "Oh, yes, this brute seems like precisely the kind of man who would immediately do just that and not immediately take his revenge. He'd no doubt doff his cap and wish us a fine good evening." "He's not wearing a cap," Hattie said, unable to refute any of the rest of the assessment of the mysterious, likely dead man. He was very broad and very solid, and even in the darkness she could tell that this wasn't a man with whom one took a turn about a ballroom. This was the kind of man who ransacked a ballroom. "What do you feel?" Nora pressed. "No pulse," though she wasn't exactly sure where one would find a pulse. "But he's warm." Dead men were not warm, and this man was very warm, like a fire in winter, the kind of warm that made someone realize how cold she might be. Ignoring the silly thought, Hattie moved her fingers down the column of his neck, to the place where it disappeared beneath the collar of his shirt, where the ridge of his shoulder and the slope of the rest of him met in a fascinating indentation. "Anything now? Quiet!" Hattie held her breath. "Nothing," she shook her head. "Christ!" It wasn't a prayer. Hattie couldn't have agreed more, but then, there, a small flutter. She pressed a touch more firmly. The flutter became steady, slow, even. "I feel it," she said. "He's alive," she repeated herself. "He's alive." She exhaled, long and relieved. "He's not dead." Excellent. But it doesn't change the fact that he's unconscious in the carriage and you have somewhere to be. Nora paused. We should leave him and take the curricle. Hattie had been planning for this particular excursion on this particular night for a full 3 months. This was the night that would begin her 29th year, the year her life would become her own, the year she would become her own. And she had a very specific plan for a very specific location at a very specific hour, for which she had donned a very specific frock. And yet, as she stared at the man in her carriage, specific seemed not at all important. What seemed important was seeing his face. Clinging to the handle at the edge of the door, Hattie collected the lantern from the upper rear corner of the carriage before swinging back out to face Nora, whose gaze flickered immediately to the unlit container. Nora tilted her head. Hattie, leave him. We'll take the curricle. Just a peek, Hattie replied. The tilt became a slow shake. If you peek, you'll regret it. I have to peek, Hattie insisted, casting about for a decent reason, ignoring the odd fact that she was unable to tell her friend the truth. I have to untie him. Not necessarily, Nora pointed out. Someone thought he was best left tied up, and who are we to disagree? Hattie was already reaching into the pocket of the carriage door for a flint. What of your plans? There was plenty of time for her plans. Just a peek, she repeated, the oil in the lantern catching fire. She closed the door and turned to face the carriage, lifting the light high, casting a lovely golden glow over. Oh my, Nora choked back a laugh. Not such a bad gift after all, it seems. The man had the most beautiful face Hattie had ever seen, the most beautiful face anyone had ever seen. She leaned closer, taking in his warm bronze skin, the high cheekbones, the long straight nose, the dark slashes of his brows, and the impossibly long lashes that lay like sin against his cheeks. What kind of man? She trailed off, shook her head. What kind of man looked like this? What kind of man looked like this and somehow landed in the carriage of Hattie Sedley, a woman who was very unused to being in the vicinity of men who looked like this? You're embarrassing yourself, Nora said. You're staring and your jaw has gone fully slack. Hattie closed her mouth but did not stop staring. Hattie, we have to go. A pause then. Unless you've changed your mind. The casual question brought Hattie back to the moment, to her plan. She shook her head, lowered the lantern. I haven't. Nora sighed and placed her hands on her hips, staring past Hattie into the carriage. You get his bottom and I'll take his top, then. She looked to a shadowed alcove behind her. He can resume consciousness there. Hattie's heart pounded. We can't leave him here. We can't? No. Nora slid her a look. Hattie, we can't take him with us just because he looks like a Roman statue. Hattie blushed in the darkness. I hadn't noticed. You lost the power of speech. She cleared her throat. We can't take him because Augie left him here. Nora's lips flattened into a perfect straight line. You don't know that. I know, Hattie said, holding the lantern near the rope at the man's wrists and sweeping it down to the place where he was bound at the ankles. Because August Sedley can't tie a carrick bend worth a damn, and I fear that if we leave this man here, he'll find his way loose and head straight for my useless brother. That, and if the stranger didn't find his way loose, who knew what Augie would do to him? Her brother was as cabbage-headed as he was reckless, a combination that routinely required Hattie's intervention. Which, incidentally, was a significant reason for her decision to claim her 29th year as her own. And still, here her infernal brother was, ruining everything. Unaware of Hattie's thoughts, Nora said, Recently unconscious or no, this doesn't look like a man who loses in a fight. The understatement was not lost on Hattie. She sighed, reaching in and hanging the now glowing lantern on its peg, taking the opportunity to cast a long, lingering look at the man in her carriage. Hattie Sedley had learned something else in her 28 years, 364 days. If a woman had a problem, it was best she solve it herself. She pulled herself up into the carriage, stepping carefully over the man on the floor, before looking back at wide-eyed Nora on the drive below. Come on, then. We'll drop him on our way,